bit of an introduction to myself. I've been practicing mindfulness meditation for about 6 years, and for the last 5 years, I've spent a lot of time doing a lot of retreats, including longer retreats of a month or more, and a period of practice in Burma. And as another announcement I should make, next Wednesday evening, four Sangha members and myself included will be having a discussion about retreats, retreat practice. And if you haven't been on retreats and are interested in finding out about retreats, please join us. We'll be describing how the retreats work and describing some of our own experiences, and there'll be plenty of time for questions. So if you're interested, please join us. Tonight, I'd like to describe something of my own practice, and in particular, talk about how I came to the Dharma. So first, I'll give a little bit of a background to set the context. I had been involved with a relationship with a man named Richard for about 9 years, and we had very different goals for the relationship. And in particular, I wanted marriage and he didn't. And leaving the relationship was very difficult for me. It was something I had tried to do a few times during the 9 years because of the different goals we had. But I always had it was always very difficult for me. So I realized at some point that I needed to put some physical distance between us. And in order to do that, I did something that I had been wanting to do for a very long time, which was to join the Peace Corps. So I applied and was accepted and was posted to the South Pacific. When I departed for the Peace Corps, I expected that the relationship would just kind of wither from lack of contact. And in fact, this was supported by the fact that Richard said that he wouldn't write to me. So I thought, okay, you know, if there's no contact at all, definitely the relationship will wither. So I left basically expecting that to be the case. And I was quite surprised when he did write. He wrote about every week, and I wrote quite frequently also. About 10 months into my stay there, he came to visit for a month. And we had a great visit. It was wonderful. And then a couple of months after he returned to the States, he called me on the phone and proposed to me. And this kind of was surprising, but I was quite happy and accepted the proposal. And then I was stunned 6 weeks later when he called me and told me that he was in love with someone else. It took us another month about to finally and completely break up, but I was pretty devastated. And the Buddha says that we come to spiritual practice through meeting suffering. He said an encounter with suffering will either lead to bewilderment or to search. I'd encountered suffering in my life many times before this particular incident, and it had led to a kind of search for me, mostly in the area of psychotherapy and self-healing, but it hadn't particularly led to a spiritual or religious search. Partly that was because I was an atheist and an intellectual, and my encounter with religion in my childhood and in my teens had led me to feel and to believe that religion basically offered mostly a kind of a blind faith. And that was not something that my intellectual side would really let me accept. Bhikkhu Bodhi is an American monk who lives in Sri Lanka, has this to say about how suffering leads to spiritual path. And what he says is, since it is suffering that impels us to seek the way to liberation, suffering is called the supporting condition for faith. By itself, however, the confrontation with suffering, even at the level of mature reflection, It's not sufficient to generate faith. For faith to arise, two conditions are required. The first is the awareness of suffering, which makes us recognize the need for a liberative path. The second is the encounter with the teaching that proclaims a liberative path. I had encountered spiritual teachings before, mostly in my early 20s, the teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh through the book The Miracle of Mindfulness and Krishnamurti in particular were books that I was very drawn to in my 20s. What happened with my encounter with those teachings at that point was that with the book The Miracle of Mindfulness in particular, I would be reading the book in the evening and think, wow, I was very drawn to this idea of mindfulness and thought, this sounds really great. I'm going to try this. I'm going to do this tomorrow when I go to work. I'm going to practice this mindfulness. And the next I would remember of it was the next night when I got back home and was picking up the book to read it again. After a couple of weeks of that, I kind of forgot about it. So at this point, at this in this case with the breakup with Richard, the search that arose as a response to that feeling of devastation was along the lines of what it had been in the past, because I hadn't really met the teachings directly, except for about 15 years earlier in reading those books. So what I was compelled to do was to call friends who knew me and who knew Richard and who knew a little bit about our relationship. I felt like I needed to process the relationship in some way. One of those friends that I contacted, my friend Chris, responded by calling me on the phone, and it was a wonderful gift for her to do that. I was 7,000 miles away, and we talked for a very long time. We talked for a couple of hours. She had been reading about the Dharma for a few years and had just started meditating herself. And some of her interest and excitement in what she had discovered in the practice kind of intrigued me. And she asked me if she could send me a few books. And I said yes. I was very interested in what she had to say and in her own experiences that she had talked about. So I said she could send me the books. One of the books that she sent me was Everyday Zen by Joko Beck. And my reading of that book at the time was that it was a book that very much stressed application of mindfulness in daily life. And this message really resonated very strongly for me with my situation. And it didn't ask me to believe anything. It really presented a set of methods for watching my mind. And it gave me a hope that training my mind would actually lead me to a little bit of a release from the pain that I was feeling. Meditation itself at that point didn't appeal to me at all. So I once again just tried to apply the mindfulness in my day. And this time, because I believe of the encounter with the very strong suffering that I was experiencing, the connection of the suffering with seeing this teaching, I was impelled to really motivated to make this work and to pay attention. I also spent quite a bit of time reflecting on the teachings, thinking about what I was reading. So I had no training at all. There weren't people there to teach me how to meditate. I just had this book that Chris sent me, and I probably read it about 3 or 4 times over the space of a few months. It was the only Dharma I had. But there were two early realizations that I had about my difficult experiences, my difficult emotions, that kind of spurred on my interest in the practice. And the first one was that I realized that the anger that I felt at Richard caused me a great deal of pain, and it did absolutely nothing to him. This was kind of made very obvious to me by the fact that I was 7,000 miles away. There was no way that my anger, my lashing out, could touch him at all. And one thing the Buddha says about anger is that it's like a hot coal. We pick it up thinking we're going to throw it at somebody and burn them when it hits them. But what we do is we burn ourselves first. And that's very much what I was experiencing. The other recognition was triggered when my father came to visit, and we were spending some time in the ocean, and he told me that he didn't know how to float, that floating was not something he could do. And I thought this was kind of odd, because I thought, when you die, you float. Why doesn't he float? So I asked him to show me. And I saw he lay on his back, and I saw all the muscles in his body, in his abdomen, contract. And he sank. And so I tried it myself. I lay on my back, I was completely relaxed, and I floated with ease. But as soon as I contracted the muscles in my body, I sank. And I thought, maybe the anger that I'm experiencing is like that. Maybe it's like a contraction that's keeping me from floating in life. So those two recognitions were kind of the first realizations that the anger that I was experiencing was something in me. It wasn't something that had been put upon me. It was something I was doing to myself, like my father was contracting his muscles. I was contracting in the anger myself. After a few months of just reflecting and I don't even know what I was doing at that point because I didn't have much training at all. But I began to realize that part of the reason why meditation was called practice was because it would help me. It would help me to be more aware in my daily life. And so I thought, well, maybe the meditation would actually be something good to do. So I went down to the library, a little tiny library in this little tiny town where I was posted, and looked for books on meditation. And there were a couple. There weren't many, but there were a couple. And one of them described a method of counting the breath. So I began a very simple practice of just counting the breath. Another thing that happened around that time, a few months after I had started the practice, was that I realized it would be very helpful for me to return to the States for a little while. And there were two main reasons for that. I realized that when I left for the Peace Corps, I had left a number of things with Richard, and I knew that I was going to have to see him again when I returned to kind of get my things and to close the relationship. And the thought of that happening 10 months from now, from the time, was just kind of untenable to me. I just thought, I can't wait 10 months to close this relationship off. It was too painful to think of having it open. But I realized I was thinking about actually leaving the Peace Corps, just leaving my assignment. But I realized I don't have to actually leave. All I need to do is go home for a period of time, get my things, close up, close off the loose ends, and then return to the Peace Corps. And with that thought of coming back home for a period of time, I realized I could get some training in meditation. I could learn a little bit more than I could learn from this one book that I had. So I requested a leave from the Peace Corps, and they granted it. They granted a full month leave. So I returned back, and out of that month, I came and stayed with my friend Chris, and out of that month, I spent maybe 5 hours total with Richard getting things sorted out. And the rest of the time, I spent, my friend Chris brought me to the center, introduced me to the Sangha, and took me to Spirit Rock to a few day-long sittings. So I learned a little bit more about meditation and about techniques for dealing with what I was going through. So returning to the South Pacific, I took a whole bunch of books back with me. I took tapes back with me. So I had some support. I had really appreciated the support of Sangha that I had experienced in the month that I came back, and I felt like I needed to take something back with me. So even though I had learned a little bit more about actual meditation, My practice continued to primarily be in the realm of daily life. I did meditate for about 20 to 30 minutes a day, but my main interest was in understanding how to deal with the emotions that were just buffeting me around. One book that I brought back with me suggested that, or pointed out that trying to be mindful all the time in your day is quite a challenging thing to do, and that you'll just end up feeling like you're failing if you try to do that. And this book suggested picking a couple of projects to use as a focus for your mindfulness practice. And so I did that. I picked two things. I picked something very neutral, which was paying attention when I switched from DOS to Windows on my computer. And as I was a computer consultant in the Peace Corps working for the Development Bank, this happened about three or four times an hour during my workday. So it was every 15 to 20 minutes there would be a little wake-up bell. And the other thing that I picked was attending to my anger. That was really the emotion that was the most out of control in my life at that point. The anger that I was dealing with was primarily in my daily life, not in my meditation, because I was so new at the meditation, anger didn't particularly come up while I was meditating. I was still just trying to count the breath and to note rising, falling. And in some ways, I think it was good that I was just trying to concentrate on something very simple during the meditation because it gave me a break from the intensity of my emotions. But it certainly wasn't planned. When I first started paying attention to my anger, I would be in a full-blown rage before I remembered, oh, I'm supposed to be paying attention to this. And it was very painful at that point. By the time I was in a full-blown rage, it was very painful and very difficult to stay present. I didn't have a lot of instructions about working with emotions, about feeling them in the body or noticing the thoughts and not feeding the thoughts. So basically, I think what I did at that point was just to recognize I'm angry. And I think that what was happening at that point was just a simple recognition. But even that simple recognition served to kind of cut the stream of propelling thoughts that were feeding the anger. So over the course of a few months of just trying to pay attention to the anger in this very simple way, I began to notice that I was waking up earlier and earlier in the process. I wouldn't be in quite as much of a full-blown rage when I noticed, oh, I'm angry. And just over time, it just seemed like earlier and earlier I would notice. And then one day, I was doing something very simple in the kitchen. I think I was cutting an apple or something. And I wasn't angry, I was just involved in cutting the apple. And I noticed a thought in my mind about Richard. And I noticed the kind of inclination to get on that thought and ride it right into anger. There's kind of this motivation to become angry. And I saw, since I wasn't angry when this thought arose and this recognition arose, I saw that I had a choice. That I didn't have to get on that thought. And I didn't get on the thought, and I didn't get angry, and I was just completely blown away. It was a really crucial moment in my early practice to recognize how powerful the practice of mindfulness is to be able to show that kind of seed of where emotions come from. Just a fleeting thought through the mind can take us right into very strong emotions. So this insight spurred me into the interest of looking at other emotions that I was experiencing at the time. Sadness was another big one that I hadn't looked at too much. And in particular, I was noticing sadness a lot as I was going to bed at night. And from my, you know, kind of I had studied psychology in college, and I had kind of thought, well, you know, the reason I'm sad at night is because I'm alone, I'm lonely, I'm going to bed alone, I'm, you know, don't have a relationship in my life, so I'm sad about these things. That made perfect sense to me. But I just started watching the feeling of sadness as it came up. And over a few nights, as I was watching the sadness, I realized that the sadness arose as I was setting my digital alarm clock to go to bed at night. I thought that was kind of odd, that it would somehow be connected with setting the alarm clock. I just kept watching a few more nights. And I don't know, it wasn't too many more nights later, but maybe three or four nights later, I noticed a thought go through my mind as I was setting the alarm clock. Actually, it was an image that appeared in my mind. And the image was, I was in Disneyland with Richard, and we were looking up at a marquee where there was a digital clock. So I could see the connection, how the memory arose. It arose because of the sense impression of the digital alarm clock that I was setting. That was the link to the memory. And I could see that the reason the sadness came up was because it was a reaction to that memory. And again, I was amazed at the power of mindfulness to show that kind of seed of where emotions come from. And in this particular case, over the next few nights, I was even more amazed, because the next night as I went to go to bed and to set my alarm clock, the recognition and the memory of all that I had learned the night before came to my mind. That same memory came to my mind. But the sadness did not come up. I think somehow the recognition of how the reactivity to that thought created the sadness, it took the power out of that emotion to create the sadness again. So the sadness never arose in the same way. Not to say I didn't get sad about the relationship, but just that kind of regular routine, every night I go to bed sad, that stopped. So the power of mindfulness that I experienced while watching these painful emotions really made my interest in continuing the practice very strong. And as I returned from the Peace Corps about 10 months later, Chris, my friend who'd sent me the books, brought me to this Sangha and introduced me to Gil. And I did Gil's introductory class and some day-long sittings, and attended my first 10-day retreat about 6 months later. And after that six-month retreat, I knew that I had found a practice that would be very, very central to my life. I don't think I knew, actually, at that point, how central it would be in my life, but I knew it was something that I would be doing for the rest of my life. So that's the story about how I came to the Dharma. But I see I've got a little bit more time, and what I'd like to do is tell you a little bit about how I continued practicing with these very strong emotions, because they didn't simply go away. It was years. It was many, many years of working with these emotions before I got some distance from them. So I'd like to describe a little bit about that. Actually, after I returned from the Peace Corps, it got a little more difficult. The emotions got stronger and more challenging, because I returned to the place of work where I had been working before I left for the Peace Corps, and Richard worked at that same place. So I didn't see him very often, but every few weeks I would hear his voice or see him in the hall, and it would be very, very painful. So at this time, I was learning a lot of new practices, metta and forgiveness and mindfulness of the body, how to pay attention to emotions in the body, how to pay attention to the thoughts that were arising around emotions. And of all of these practices, it seemed most obvious that the metta practice and the forgiveness practices would be the sort of obvious places to work with these difficult emotions. But I found them very difficult to work with Richard. And in fact, in the instructions I was getting about the metta and the forgiveness practice, when we came to the place of sending metta or forgiveness to a difficult person, the instructions were very often, don't pick the most difficult person. No, pick an easy, difficult person. And Richard just was never an easy, difficult person. So I just kind of let go of trying to do those practices with him. What I did find that I could do was kind of to let go of the emotions. I was learning that I had the ability to concentrate a little bit and that I could shift the focus of my attention from the emotion to something very neutral, like the feeling of my feet on the ground or the feeling of my butt in the chair where I was working. So as these emotions would come up, the way I would deal with them was to recognize them and say, oh, there's anger, there's bitterness, there's despair, there's hatred. And just say, not now, and put it aside. And then return to something very neutral for a minute or two. And after that point, I could go on with whatever I was doing without kind of being churned up about the emotion. So over the course of several years of doing this practice, I began to see that the difficult emotions were coming up less and less frequently. And what was happening, actually, was that positive emotions were coming up more frequently. I was experiencing a lot more happiness and joy, delight in being with friends and in just life and in the practice itself. And the other thing that was happening was that I was recognizing that the act of just recognizing the difficult emotion and putting it aside was letting go of those painful emotions. After kind of on reflection later, I kind of envisioned all of those painful emotions like strung on a very long string and wound up real tight inside of me on a spool. And that each time one of them came up, it was like a little bit of it spooled out off that, out of me. And then I put it aside. And then a little bit more would spool out, and I'd put it aside. And because I wasn't feeding those emotions, it didn't get wound back up. And finally, over time, it just all came out. One day I remember thinking, it's been a really long time since I had any of those difficult emotions around Richard. I wonder where they are. And I kind of checked. Feeling in my body, where are they? And I couldn't find them. I couldn't find any seeds of those feelings. And I thought, wow, I wonder if they're just really gone. I really had a kind of a disbelief about it. I assumed that I was deceiving myself somehow. And I had a chance to kind of check this out a few weeks later when I saw Richard again, and there were none of those feelings arose. And over the course of the last year and a half or so, it's really grown much stronger, my sense of forgiveness. There's this very strong sense of not wishing that anything was any different. That no, I wouldn't want to go through it again, but you know, it's okay what happened. And also a strong sense of metta for Richard, of just wanting him to be happy. So I guess in terms of, you know, kind of a little theme of the evening, the thing I'd like to just say is that very, very simple recognition, very simple mindfulness can be very powerful. At least I found that to be the case in dealing with difficult emotions. You know, I didn't really need to have that deep investigation of what the emotions felt like in the body. It is just simply recognizing, oh, this is what I'm feeling. This is what I'm feeling, without aversion. It's very, very powerful. So I'd like to close my talk with a poem that resonates very strongly with me about suffering and how we often don't see suffering as our source of growth and strength. This poem is by Rainer Maria Rilke, and it's from his Duino Elegies. This is an excerpt from the 10th elegy. Someday, emerging at last from the violent insight, let me sing out jubilation and praise to assenting angels. Let not even one of the clearly struck hammers of my heart fail to sound because of a slack, a doubtful, or a broken string. Let my joyfully streaming face make me more radiant. Let my hidden weeping arise and blossom. How dear will you be to me then, you nights of anguish? Why didn't I kneel more deeply to accept you, inconsolable sisters, and surrendering, lose myself in your loosened hair? How we squander our hours of pain. How we gaze beyond them into the bitter duration to see if they have an end, though they are really our winter-enduring foliage, our dark evergreen, one season in our inner year, not only a season in time, but our place and settlement, foundation and soil and home. So I'd like to open it up for discussion, comments, questions, or just anything that anybody would like to say, and maybe in particular about their own practice in daily life. Steve?
Yeah, I agree with you, Andrea. Daily practice is extremely powerful, and once you get over the hump of doing it, getting into the pattern of doing it, because it's difficult to stop doing it, and you forget, but you keep up the momentum of it, eventually you'll have tone. Momentum just go by itself, is, I know it's really transformed my practice.
Yeah, thank you. That's wonderful. In my particular situation, the momentum was generated by the suffering. the suffering was so strong that kind of just pulled me along. It's actually a little more difficult for me now to practice in daily life than it was then. It was actually quite easy at that point because there was that strong momentum.
Could you say a little bit about your longer retreats and how that relates to what you were saying? Anything that comes up, just curious.
Well, the longer retreats give me more of an opportunity to really explore the depths of my personality structure. some of my time on long retreats is just spent seeing, the impermanence of things and the how things change, but there's also a period of time on those long retreats where I definitely hit these periods of on my last retreat, in fact, I hit a strong period of feelings of unworthiness and self-hatred, and I spent quite a bit of time looking at those, and some of the psychological insights I had into some of those difficult feelings, actually, it was interesting, it paved the way for some deeper insights into just the emptiness of those feelings, just the I think practice has both the side of the psychological insight of dealing with a lot of these difficult painful things of our history and the spiritual insight of opening up to the impermanence of life and of all experience. And for me, on this last retreat, I definitely saw how the deep insight into a psychological insight could open me up to being able to be there for the spiritual insight, to the emptiness of it. Is that... If people have anything they'd like to share about how they came to practice too, that would be interesting to hear.
I've only been coming a short time, but I'm relating to your story. I live in a busy household with three teenagers, and there's such upheaval and anger and reactions, and I'm finding I need to find something to keep a base and to keep even keel. So I'm just stuck.
Well, that's great. I encourage you to just keep it really simple. I found early in my practice that, I mean, looking back, you know, that simplicity was very helpful. You know, just a simple recognition of what you're feeling can be really, really powerful. Patience helps too. Oh, yes. Yes. It's had radical impact, very, very radical impact on my life. I started by really deciding that the retreats were wonderful. After that very first retreat, I knew that I needed to do more retreats. And so I kind of organized my work life so that I could do a lot of retreats. The first year that I came back, I did 5 10-day or longer retreats. So I kind of, you know, that was all my vacations. You know, actually, I was a consultant, so I could schedule my time pretty easily. The retreats themselves have radically altered my priorities, such that at this point I'm no longer working, and I'm planning on going to Burma for a year to do extended practice, leaving in the fall. So it has very radically changed my life, very, very radically. I had no idea, no idea this was in store.
Your experience. I came to practice also because of a relationship that just wasn't going the way that I thought it ought to go. Didn't seem to be I felt like something was missing in my life, and it was wasn't anything that felt like somebody else had to give it to me. And so for me, coming to the practice has really been finding that kind of accepting of myself, kind of accepting of my experience and the lessening of the aversion to it. So for me, it hasn't been so much anger as just aversion, you know, and really being willing to look at what was going on from moment to moment. And by not pushing things away, they seem to dissolve on their own. Whereas the harder I pushed, the harder they persisted. So it seems sort of a difficult lesson.
Thank you.
I came to the practice primarily to find out if I could have a relationship with everything.
That's lovely.
Having heard your story, I don't know if if I could say that I really went through a period of suffering, so I guess I didn't. But I often found that I would make choices based on not liking or liking something. For example, I would switch channels. I wouldn't like Fox, let's go BBC or CNN or something. And that really, those, you know, every day changes, every moment I make decisions like this, I don't like this. And I was wondering if there would be a, if this was natural or unnatural, whether what I was doing was really holding myself into believing that one thing is better than the other. And the reason why I am doing this, why I'm practicing, is to find out if the natural state is really a sense of not creating the decision, of not liking something over the other, of not liking anger over, you know, equanimity, or liking equanimity over anger. That's why it's so
special. Have you come to any recognitions?
The amazing thing is that while I practice, I have seen things that I never thought would happen, for example. Is that I don't get angry at all. It's not that I was a very violent person to begin with, but I would get angry at not just people who hurt me, but, for example, I would listen to someone saying something on TV that would, what is he saying, you know? And now I'm able to slowly, completely understand where it's coming from. And now say, okay, this guy is wrong, this guy, or this guy is bad, this guy is good. I want to blur the distinction and see if that is really the natural state. And see if the distinction is something that we create for ourselves. You talk about impermanence, for example, whether creating the contradiction between impermanence and permanence, or trying to juggle between the two, whether we can be in a state where we don't have to think about permanence or impermanence, because, you know, we're thinking about time when you think about impermanence, whether it's possible to be in a state where time doesn't exist, where change doesn't exist, or you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's why I'm doing this.
Oh, that's lovely. That's I find too that the very powerful place for me in practice right now is noticing where my preferences are, and noticing how I react in those preferences. It's a very, very powerful place for me. It actually can lead me right into a place of equanimity, kind of as you were saying, with, you know, beginning to notice how you react to the people that made you angry. I think maybe it's a little bit of noticing that point that's letting you not go into the anger so much.
And the reason why I say this is a lot of people ask me, it's okay to be angry. They say, it's okay to be angry. In fact, you should be angry. Otherwise, you can't fight injustice. I had a hard time answering it because I didn't know the answer myself. But I'm slowly beginning to find that reacting with anger is really not a natural thing to do. Reacting with mindfulness is really the natural way to do it. Sometimes we just fool ourselves and being, no, it's okay to be angry. It's because we want to escape from our, you know, deeper prejudices.
Yeah. Thank you.
So, yeah, you see all these, whatever you said is completely right. You see all these things happen. And I never expected it to happen.
Somebody said to me, why did you, what brought you to meditation? And I kind of like said, suffering. But I kind of meant it as a joke. But at the same time that I said it lightheartedly, I knew that it was real. And it was the kind of thing where I had was also a Peace Corps volunteer. And when I came back, this is way back in the 70s, and I took up transcendental meditation. And I did it for about 5 years, and then eventually my life changed and ended up getting married. And 17, 18 years later, I went through a divorce, which was very difficult, lasted about 3 years. And about a year and a half into it, I was just in in the library and I picked up some books about mindfulness meditation. And I started doing it on a daily basis. And during the process of my divorce, I was just amazed at how much anger I saw coming up during my meditation. It almost scared me, all the anger that I could see. And I said, wow, where is all that coming from? And it was like, it was such an insight for me just to see the anger. And I was dreaming, and I was being angry when I dreamed, and I was angry when I was awake. And I was always thought as this really calm person who was always easygoing. And so I kind of scared myself just by recognizing and seeing all of this anger. But in a period of about a year, I would say that the change was very dramatic, that very seldom, and by the time that the divorce was almost finished, instead of anger, I was often feeling a great sense of compassion for the situation and even for my wife. And I could see her anger, but I saw it as her suffering and not as anger. And so I was really quite surprised by how quickly it changed the way that I saw my reality. And my reality changed dramatically just because of how what I was seeing. And as I saw it day after day, my mind began to change, and as a result, I began to change in a sense also. And it was very gradual, but it was very, very significant. And so I also appreciated your sharing your story, because I think that certainly I could relate to just seeing, as you were talking, what was going on and how that seeing, just the seeing in itself, seems to be such a transformation. And the seeing, it seems to me, is more transforming than anything else.
Definitely. I completely agree with that. It's just even very simple seeking, very simple. I feel such a gratitude for that gift, as I sense that you also do.
Yeah, it's a very positive thing.
Well, we can sit for a few minutes if there's nothing else. It'll be about maybe 10 minutes. Thank you.